This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In the age of Fukushima, past the time of dead terrorists and royal weddings, underlying deadly storms and higher food prices, we continue our relentless carbon war against the atmosphere and the sea. In this Radio EcoShock program, five guests take us through the process. Almost the father of public health warnings on climate change, Harvard's Dr. Paul Epstein is our guest. Before the deadly tornadoes in the American South, he specifically warned of more violent weather. An advisor to governments, Dr. Epstein talks about climate impacts on the air we breathe, smog, and the 1 out of every 10 Americans suffering from asthma. Just for the horror, I'll toss in a few minutes from another climate and health talk, this time Dr. Tim Takaro in Vancouver. Did you know even moderate projections of warming will move malaria-bearing mosquitoes as far north as Scandinavia or the province of Quebec in Canada? Dr. Takaro and his co-speaker Dr. Michael Brower agree. We are already committed to significant climate disruption. We need new models of public health trying to adapt, trying to save lives. Then we'll talk with one of the premier environmental journalists of our day. As global warming revved up in the public mind, Andy Revkin was the environment reporter for the New York Times. His blog .earth continues to connect the big stories with a science edge. We'll wrap up with two interviews asking, why aren't schools preparing kids for a morphing ecosphere? Captain Paul Salen has a new book about fixing green teaching. Charlie heads up the Ocean Conservation Society in Southern California. And from New England, active primary school teacher Katie Farber tells us a way to connect students to the community, to the real world, is perfect for the transition movement that we're going to need and great for disconnected kids. Don't miss her bright green activism or her blog, Non-Toxic Kids. I'm Alex Smith. 4 new interviews, 1 speech clip, 1 hour. Here we go. Dr. Paul R. Epstein is a world-recognized expert in the growing relationship between climate change and health. An instructor at the Harvard Medical School, Dr. Epstein is associate director for Harvard Center for Health and the Global Environment. Now Paul Epstein has teamed up with a very good science writer, Dan Ferber, to tell us what we need to know about this underreported side of climate disruption. The book is Changing Planet, Changing Health, How the Climate Crisis Threatens Our Health, and What We Can Do About It. Dr. Epstein, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. Pleasure to be with you.
There are a lot of ways climate can determine health, as I'm reading your book, and in a minute I'd like to go into some detail on just 2 aspects, the impacts of stronger storms and new risks in the air we breathe. But to whet our appetite, could you list off some of the other problems that doctors are encountering from changes to our climate system?
Sure. There are 5 categories, really. The first is heat waves, increasing in duration, intensity, and extent, but also the nighttime temperatures are going up faster than overall temperatures. That's what changes the quality of the heat waves and makes them particularly dangerous. Infectious disease, vector-borne, meaning mostly mosquito, but sometimes ticks and rodents, these too respond to climate, and here there's 2 dimensions. Temperature affects the potential range of these mosquito-borne diseases especially, while it's the extreme weather events that affects the timing, intensity, and duration and location of outbreaks. And then there's asthma and allergies, which we'll talk about. And then a new category that's recently emerged is the wild winter weather that we're seeing. There's clear evidence that there are changes in the North Atlantic, in the ice cover, due to ocean warming primarily, that affecting the jet stream and the winds that blow across Europe and so on. So this is a new dimension of climate instability. And the last is diseases across taxonomic groups, meaning plants, crops, forests, marine life, also affected by pests and pathogens, meaning disease agents. Climate plays a role in increasing that spread.
Well, we have a vested interest in breathing. I was surprised to learn there's more pollen in the air, so much so that 1 in 10 Americans suffer from ragweed allergies. How is that connected to global warming?
Well, there are really 5 ways in which we can connect the burning of fossil fuels to the increase in allergens. First, let me say that asthma has almost doubled in this country since 1980, and we can identify 5 factors. One is that carbon dioxide itself increases the growth of weeds. Weeds, opportunistic species, love this stuff. And so they make more pollen. That's in the fall. Early flowering plants and trees in the spring also make more pollen. So spring and fall allergies are affected by more pollen. And the pollen actually becomes more allergenic when grown under higher levels of CO2. Also, burning fossil fuels contributes particulate matter. We know that clogs the lungs, but it also attaches to the pollen and fungal spores and helps deliver them deep inside our lungs and affects the deep airways. Then there's photochemical smog or ozone, which comes from the emissions of fossil fuels combined with other agents from trees and so on. And then there's heat waves itself, which increase the reaction of these chemicals to form more photochemical smog. And then finally, we see with climate change the extension of the allergy and asthma season. Spring is coming earlier, fall persisting longer. All told, the season spring to fall has increased 2 to 4 weeks in the Northern Hemisphere, depending on the latitude. So here are a whole bunch of issues related to climate, but also just to the burning of the fossil fuels themselves.
So Americans don't realize it, but many of them are suffering longer and worse already because of climate change.
We believe they are. This is already in effect. Without climate change, just the higher levels of carbon dioxide is something that we know. Since the pre-industrial era, when there were 280 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, now it's above 390. And these levels, we believe, are having a significant impact on ragweed, other weeds of agriculture, by the way. Poison ivy is getting stronger, and the chemical within it, urushiol, which causes the contact dermatitis, is also strengthened when we grow poison ivy under higher concentrations of carbon dioxide. So just the CO2, forget climate for a moment. Climate then extends the seasons where these things are active and our exposure is increased.
And you mentioned the heat island effect. In the New York Times, you wrote cities can be up to 7 degrees hotter than the surrounding countryside, and that's no joke. We believe 11,000 people died in the Russian heat emergency of 2010 in Moscow alone, and thousands died in Paris a few years earlier. But aren't some of those heat deaths preventable?
They are, with early warning systems, which we have begun to institute in U.S. cities. And if one does prepare with an early warning that there's going to be a heat wave, prepare air-conditioned facilities, treatment facilities, transport capability, all of these things can help decrease the lethality and mortality from heat waves. We're going to have to provide air conditioning at night now that we know that the nighttime temperatures are not going down so fast. So we've got to learn from the changing quality of heat waves how to best prepare and adapt. But the heat island effect magnifies all of this, and there the particulates, the ozone, and indeed higher concentrations of carbon dioxide collect under this CO2 dome or heat island effect, and all of these emissions are contributing to the heat in the cities as well as the buildings themselves.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our Harvard Medical School guest, Dr. Paul R. Epstein. Along with science writer Dan Ferber, Paul Epstein has boiled down the advice he gives expert committees and governments all over the world into a book for the rest of us. The title is Changing Planet, Changing Health. Dr. Epstein, let's move on to the health impacts of storms. We know flooding or extreme winds can kill, but why bring in climate change?
Well, we know now that we are seeing stronger storms, not necessarily more storms, but the storms that occur are stronger. And that we attribute to the warming of the oceans. In fact, there are models that show if Hurricane Katrina had happened in 1980 rather than 2005, it would have been less powerful. So what's happening in the deep oceans? Since the 1950s, the oceans have accumulated 22 times as much heat as has the atmosphere and the continents. Another way of putting that is the oceans have absorbed almost 94% of the heat of global warming. Warm water evaporates faster than cool, and a warm atmosphere holds more moisture. For every 1 degree C it warms up, it can hold 7% more water vapor. So we've got a push and pull on the whole water cycle, and water is warming, ice is melting, water vapor is rising. These states of water on our planet are shifting because of the heat that's built up in the deep ocean. That's the repository, and that's the driver for the storms. Global warming is causing climate change, meaning warming and change in weather patterns, as well as sea level rise. And the main pathway is through this heat buildup in the deep ocean.
On the dismal side, it looks like pumped-up weather, such as extreme precipitation events, hurt the people least able to protect themselves or recover. From the medical perspective, can you compare, say, the impacts of Hurricane Mitch on Central Americans versus Hurricane Katrina in America?
Boy, that's a hard question. Certainly the socioeconomic level of development affects the impacts and how resilient communities are. Hurricane Mitch stalled over Central America for 3 days, pouring down about 6 feet of rain on Honduras and adjacent nations. And the impacts were devastating, about 11,000 deaths immediately. But again, these clusters of outbreaks of malaria and cholera and rodent-borne disease and so on. Katrina was another story, and here we see the impacts greatest on poor populations, unable to move quickly and heed warnings. But it was also an event where an enormous amount of water was poured into the city from the Gulf and then from Lake Pontchartrain and the canals that were built around it and just swamped the city. And yes, there's been recovery and build up, but as we know, it's lost about, I think, a quarter of its population. And the impacts remain on the families that were affected by the deaths, about 18,000 deaths, as well as the displacement of people. It's hard to compare. One can only just say that they're different, but they're unfortunately happening in developed as well as developing nations.
Does the medical community expect tropical diseases to appear in North America, Russia, or Europe?
Just to segue into that, one of the things that we are seeing more of, even in the United States, is waterborne disease. And 2 inches a day rains and over lead to contamination of water with sewage and wastewater, and can lead to cryptosporidiosis and E. coli and Giardia and viral infections. And we're seeing in the United States, 2 inches a day rains have gone up 14%, 4 inches a day rains have gone up 20%, and 6 inches a day rains have gone up 27% over the continental U.S. Now, that's not quite what you were asking. There are mosquito-borne diseases that are knocking at our door. Dengue fever is very prevalent in the north of Mexico, whereas it wasn't that far north several decades ago. But the most prevalent vector-borne disease in the United States is Lyme disease, carried by ticks. And we've seen an 8-fold increase of Lyme disease reports in New Hampshire over this last decade, and in Maine a 10-fold increase, and it's moved up to the border with Canada. And model did not project that Lyme disease would move so quickly. Models are based on average temperatures. In fact, there's more warming in the winter and more warming as we move towards the poles from the temperate to the tropics, boreal, and the Arctic. And so Alaska, for instance, has increased 6.5 degrees Fahrenheit, while the continental U.S. about 1 degree Fahrenheit over the last century. And that means more stinging insects, threats of mosquito-borne disease, not to mention the melting of tundra and the undermining of villages and how it's impacting entire communities.
I see Jeffrey Sachs and Al Gore have endorsed your new book. What do you hope it will do?
Just a word about food security. That's become an increasing issue globally, and that's affecting the price of basic grains in this country. And there are several dimensions of that: increased demand for meat, bioethanol replacing some of the land that's where we grow crops, so the search for energy, and then the extreme weather events that have affected crops throughout the world, like the Russian heat wave that you mentioned affected wheat crops, and in fact last summer led to food riots in Mozambique, the nation where I worked some decades ago. Now, what we hope to do with this book is help people understand that this is about their lives. The changing climate and climate instability is occurring globally, and that's the bad news. It's unstable. The instability reflected in increasing rates of change, particularly of ice, the wide variability, the swings to far extremes. These suggest that climate is unstable, and the health dimensions are some of them are direct, like through heat waves and asthma. Others are via the ecological systems that underpin our public health and provide us with food, air, water, shelter, and so on. And these are the real threats. On the other hand, unstable systems can be restabilized. And here we present some of the solutions that individuals have taken, communities, but also what can be done on a global basis with the technologies we have today, and some ideas about how to fund that and raise international funds that can help us embark on this clean energy transformation.
We've been lucky enough to spend time with Dr. Paul Epstein. His new book with co-author Dan Ferber is Changing Planet, Changing Health, How the Climate Crisis Threatens Our Health, and What We Can Do About It. I found myself excited about the science, and the science writing is top-notch, but I also found myself thinking while people are blissfully driving off to the mall, there's a strange and risky new world growing out of our addiction to fossil fuels. Find out more about this book at its website, changingplanetchanginghealth.com. Dr. Epstein, thank you for showing us an emerging future.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you for having me on.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
As we close out our segment on the public health impact of climate change, here is just one chilling example of the new risks to your health. The speaker is Dr. Tim Takaro of Simon Fraser University. He explained the impacts of more wildfires and more floods, and that leads to this short piece on the growing domain of disease-bearing mosquitoes as the climate warms.
So just very briefly, the greatest threat to humans may be the smallest, this being the threat of malaria and dengue. The reason is that the extrinsic incubation period for mosquitoes changes with temperature. And as the temperature rises, the incubation period is shorter, so that there is much more opportunity for the mosquito to feed and to infect. And that's the basic biology of why warming trends increase mosquito populations and malaria. This is a nice map of Zimbabwe, which I'll briefly run through what the different colors mean here, are different favorability for the habitat for mosquitoes. So this area in the central part of the country is a mountainous zone, and you'll notice it's cool colors. Those are the low malaria areas, and in fact, many African cities, including Harare in Zimbabwe, were built above the malaria lines when they were built 150 years ago, in some cases 200 years ago. So now, with climate change, what you're seeing is that this baseline where malaria was not a problem in Harare because of the elevation is changing. And by the year 2000, it had already changed to this extent, with Harare now moving into the orange zone. By 2050, it's predicted to be an optimal zone for the malaria mosquito. And this is happening all over the world. In fact, I'll show you in just a minute, even in North America. So another important mosquito-borne illness is dengue fever, and this just shows you the increased range of the Aedes aegypti mosquito, which is the main vector for dengue. And it has increased quite a bit in including into North America in more recent years. Here is changes in the falciparum malaria transmission potential. Again, the color code means the hotter colors, red and orange, are a greater increase in the transmission potential. And there's also a purple color here that is new disease risk, so areas that have never seen malaria, including in Scandinavia here in 2020, predicted to have new areas of endemic malaria. And I'll just point out here this little red blip here in Quebec, which will increase as you move towards the 2080s. And you'll also notice some new endemic areas predicted for interior British Columbia.
Find a link to that video complete with slides, along with the full speech by Dr. Michael Brower from the University of British Columbia, and we just heard Dr. Tim Takaro of Simon Fraser University. It's in my blog for this program. The title of the blog is Climate, Media, and Learning, and that's at ecoshock.info. The two talks on public health and climate change were part of a lecture series presented by the Pacific Institute for Climate Solutions in Victoria, BC. That was on March 31st, 2011. The video asks you to download a player from Microsoft called Silverlight. Go ahead, it's free, it's harmless, and it's a tool you'll see used more often for public lectures on the net. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Now we move on to a working example of climate journalism. That is Andy Revkin of the New York Times. For 14 years, our next guest was the environment reporter for one of the world's biggest newspapers, the New York Times. As global warming hit the charts and minds of this generation, Andy Revkin rode the whirlwind. He reported from the Arctic, from climate conferences, about a mass of scientific advances, and some social retreats. All the while, Andy kept his readers' eyes on another big bouncing ball, the continuous expansion of human population, and what that means for the wild world. Andy, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Good to be with you.
To start off, why did you leave the New York Times as a full-time journalist while you were at the top?
Well, there were a few things that were percolating for several years. One was, you know, if you do something for a long period of time, you start to reflect on whether you're using your time and skills to the best advantage. And I had been doing a lot of reporting on this sort of the sociological side of environmental challenges, and realized increasingly that just writing about them, even doing writing about them effectively, probably wouldn't change things, especially on an issue that's as polarized as climate. So I just had dug in on that literature and realized I'm not working at both ends of the pipeline. In other words, writing is important, communicating is important, but also understanding how people receive information and how do you make information matter, that's also important. So that pulled me toward academia. And then the Times, in this real tough world of ours, is shrinking the newsroom, and they offered in 2009 they had to get rid of 100 newsroom jobs. First time in close to 160 years they had to shrink the newsroom, and I took one of their offers of a buyout package to leave, and I still continue to write every day, of course, on .earth.
Right, and they've moved your blog, .earth, to the opinion side of the page. Does that give you more freedom to write?
It's an interesting transition. I talked to some of my friends who've made that transition, like Nick Kristoff, and it takes some time to get used to. It gives me more freedom when I really think there's something I can engage, where I have something to say that's my own conception of how the world works or doesn't work, so I can opine when I want to. But mostly the blog, .earth, is still an interrogatory thing. It's an exploratory form of journalism where I'm usually not telling you what to think or how I think, but I'm telling you this is my journey. I'm on a learning journey here. Come along with me.
I think a lot of reporting has become more personalized, perhaps because of the internet. We want to know what are the emotions involved and what should we think. And along those lines, do you think the nuclear disaster in Japan is a game changer or just another disaster story?
It's more than just a disaster story, for sure, because it has huge ripple effects for the nuclear industry, which already, you know, the main constraints on rapid expansion of nuclear were financial. But a big chunk of the financial impediments there were related to community and distrust, and not just, you know, the actual cost of the bricks and the concrete and the titanium, but the cost of making sure that a community is convinced that this is something they want nearby. And that's really hard to do. So it's clear that whatever the issues that industry already faced for expansion are much greater now, and that makes it a big deal. And by the way, I was writing a lot recently about this in terms of the perceptions of hazard versus, you know, the actual hazard as well. And it's interesting, it's really divided the environmental community profoundly.
It has indeed, with people like Monbiot and Stuart Brand saying, well, this just shows us we need more nuclear, and other people going, oh, that can't be right. I wonder whether that split in the Greens is actually going to harm the movement.
Well, the movement already is going through some very severe growing pains. Most of the 20th century history of the environmental movement built around direct problems you could see and perceive and had a framing that usually was pointing the finger at somebody like a big oil company or a politician. So there was a woe is me and a shame on you aspect to almost everything. And with the issues we face in this century, it's much harder to point at, say, an Exxon as the bad guy when we're the ones lining up to buy the gasoline and the heating oil, which I still have to rely on. I don't want to rely on it, but it's the reality and where I live in the Hudson River Valley. So what I've been trying to do is, on the blog also, is explore new ways of building a movement that would actually matter in a world heading toward 9 billion people, roughly, seeking decent lives. What would that actually look like? And it doesn't really look like a traditional environmental approach is the best approach.
It seems to me at the New York Times you were stuck in the middle. Big Oil thought you went too far, perhaps, and some environmentalists said you didn't go far enough. Did you feel some pressure from your editors and from the public? Did you even get some death threats?
I got some weird phone messages and emails, but after a certain Rush Limbaugh went after me on his radio show, and this was related to population. I had done some discussion on the blog and then on a video conference on the reality that if you care about something like global climate change, you have to really deeply consider the population side of the equation. This is not just about consumption of that the number of people, and in multiple ways, the number of people in harm's way from the risks of global warming is going up rapidly in poor places. And then the United States population is heading toward 400 million or more. And that's important to consider. And he kind of said, well, if you think people are the worst thing that ever happened to this planet, why don't you just go kill yourself and save the planet by dying? Which was an interesting thing to say to 15 million people on the radio. But that's not the, you know, yeah, I've been kind of criticized off and on by both left and right. And I don't know whether it's my familial stance as a middle child, but I do tend to see in many, many cases, not everyone, that they're, that too much of our arguments these days are sort of waged from the edges. And when you do that, there's a lot of overstatement. Hoax, catastrophe are words that were thrown around a lot in relation to climate change, and neither is really the way. If a strict interpretation of the issues doesn't come close to either, unless you have a really long time scale on the catastrophe side. And the reality is we don't have energy options we need. And so we miss the consensus too often in having polarized discourse. So I'm stuck in that middle, and I'll probably stay there.
This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org. We'll be right back in just a minute with more Radio EcoShock.